Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the 7 Investing Podcast, where we're here to empower you to invest in your future. You can learn more about our long-term investing approach and see every one of our stock market recommendations at 7investing.com. My name is Simon Erickson. I am thrilled. I am so excited to welcome my guest to the show today. John Rotanti is an old friend. He's also the host of the J-Row podcast. He's been investing long-term, or he's been helping to educate long-term investors for more than a decade. John, I think I speak for everybody when I say, welcome to the 7 Investing Podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm so glad to be here, Simon. Thank you.
John, you know, we've chatted about quite a few topics over the years, and I wanted to kind of dig into a couple of those later in the show. We'll talk about capital allocation. We'll talk about dividends and share repurchases. We'll talk about a couple of companies that are doing this well and maybe some that aren't as well. But I think that a really good way to start our conversation is a previous interview that you had with Joel Tillinghast, who, if that name is unfamiliar to a lot of people, kind of a legendary Fidelity value investor, 30-year career, you know, outperformed the market over three decades. And you recently interviewed him, and I know that he's kind of a hero to you and has a lot of the same kind of investing style as you follow. But maybe to start this conversation, you know, John, what were some of the key takeaways that you had from the conversation with Joel here recently?
So he's definitely a role model and a hero of mine in the investing world. Sorry, Simon. So it all started, you know, the first investing book I ever read, I was in college. I'm 43 now, so you know, this was well over 20 years ago, was Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. And when I read Peter Lynch's book, maybe for the only time in my life, I had an epiphany moment about what I wanted to do with my life. Maybe that was the only time in my life. And two things happened when I read Peter Lynch's book. One is I had the epiphany that I kind of understand this math. I was always good at it. I didn't major in math or anything. I wasn't, you know, very advanced in math, but I understood the basics very well. I was always good in math. I was comfortable in math. And when I read Peter Lynch's book, you know, he goes through a couple ratios in the book, a couple metrics in the book. All of that made sense to me. And at the time, I didn't know what a stock was, but the math made sense. So that was one epiphany that went off. And the other one was, as an 18-year-old, I think I want to do this for a living. And so Peter Lynch's book, to me, had the most impact on me because it set off that realization moment of what I wanted to do with my life. And it gave me the confidence that I thought I could be decent at it. And to note, over the years, I started to follow Fidelity because that's where Peter Lynch worked. You know, he was only portfolio manager there for really 13 years, at least on the Magellan Fund. But I ended up subscribing to a newsletter that followed Fidelity funds because I wanted to learn more about Fidelity. This was not a Fidelity product. This was a separate individual that believed in Fidelity's products, and he put out a newsletter. I think it was like Fidelity Monitor or something like that. I don't remember the name, but I subscribed to it for a few years, and that's when I first came across Joel Tillinghast, because this Fidelity watcher talked about how good Joel was, and that's when I learned that Joel worked under Peter Lynch. And so that's when I sort of first became a follower and a student of Joel. You know, and then over the years, I learned that he didn't just work for Peter Lynch. Peter Lynch interviewed Joel Tillinghast. Peter Lynch hired Joel. Peter Lynch trained Joel. And Joel worked under him for several years. And Peter was like his mentor. Why would I not be interested in that, right? Like, that's like the dream scenario for almost any investor. To get hired by, trained by, study under, and work for a legend like Peter Lynch. And then, you know, Joel put out this great book. You know, and when I say I read something, like, I read it and I mark it up. I go crazy with some of this stuff. And, you know, he did, like you said, a 30-year career, and he beat the market after fees by 4 percentage points per year on average over 30 years. And that's, you know, 4 percentage points of annualized alpha is pretty impressive. What resonated with me about his style and his philosophy is he focuses on high quality companies, and he defines quality as, and it's in the interview that we posted to Seven Investing, and thank you for giving me that avenue to post it, by the way. But you know, he talks about he's looking for profitability, he's looking for lifespan, companies that are going to be around a long, long time, and he's looking for certainty in those future earnings and cash flows. He's really looking for predictability, and then valuation. And so basically, he's looking for the best businesses in the world, and he waits until they're trading at really low multiples. And that's sort of what I do. It just feels right to me. It's where I'm most comfortable within my own risk tolerance. And so that's why I look for these companies that score really highly on, you know, profitability and return metrics. They have good organic growth, but they are predictable to some degree. I can model them. I can forecast them to some degree with some degree of confidence and conviction. And then I just really wait for their stocks to get crushed. And so it becomes a game of patience.
That's fantastic, John. You know, and like you said, there's some great quotes from Joel. One of them that you included in that piece that we published up on 7investing.com was, without any concept of intrinsic value, it's impossible to gauge whether the market has already picked up on your insight. It's in the world that we're in today, right? It's kind of an ADD investing world in many ways out there. On social media, there's so much momentum. There's so many GameStops and AMCs and, you know, it's to some extent, cryptocurrencies and Bitcoins. It's nice to go back and really get into the trenches, figure out what a company is intrinsically worth, and find those mispricings out there in the market. John,
real quick, without it, I love that quote. Thank you for sharing it. Without an estimate of what you think a company's intrinsic value is, it's not just that you don't know when to buy. You also don't know when to sell. You don't know when to trim. You don't know when to add. You don't know when buybacks are intelligent or not. You don't know about acquisitions when they're intelligent or not. You literally are completely unanchored from any sense of reality of what the company is doing. You have no way to measure anything that the company is doing. And then it just becomes a guessing game. And that works for some people, but it's not how I want to invest.
Now, the discounted cash flow analysis has become kind of a standard in this industry, right? Everyone wants to bring the future free cash flows back to the present, get an intrinsic value of what the stock is worth, throw out a price target, and then when it's lower than the price target, institutions are going out and buying it. John, we'll talk about Joel's approach and the screen that he had in a minute here, but let me first ask what your approach is. How do you approach intrinsic value? How do you figure out if a stock is a good bargain right now?
I try to use a lot of methods. You know, two or three, and triangulate on what I think is a range of fair values. And for companies, when that range is narrower, I have more confidence. That's like Pepsi, right? Like Pepsi grows at like GDP plus a couple percentage points every year organically. They're really well run. They do some good capital allocation, and you get, you know, higher mid-single digit EPS growth. And it's relatively stable and predictable. And so if I was going to try to value Pepsi, which is a very good business, my estimated range of values is going to be narrower. For other companies that are earlier in their life cycle, or they have lots of different lines of businesses, some that are disruptive and innovative, some of which those lines of business are not even really earning anything yet, right? Like, for example, with Tesla, their AI, their robots, their robo-taxis, the, you know, service revenue, software revenue, high margin software revenue from FSD. All of that is very hard for me to model, at least for me to model. And so my range of estimated fair values for Tesla is going to be much wider. I use discounted cash flow models, but you know, you can make a discounted cash flow model be whatever you want. And I do a lot of guest lectures at universities, at Tulane, at Fordham. I did one recently at the University of Dayton. And I'll sit in on a lot of student stock pitches, and they'll share their models with me. And what they do almost every time without fail, because this is their first time running a DCF, I'm not critical of this at all, but they'll just make the model close to where the stock is currently trading. right? And they'll just show it, and they'll just show that the stock is 10 or 20% undervalued. You just make it work like that. And once again, that's not a criticism. This is their first time ever doing it. But you can tweak little things in the cost of capital or in the early years of revenue or in the terminal growth rate and just make it whatever you want. And so if I was a fund manager, if I was a portfolio manager, I had some analysts working for me, and all they did was bring me their DCF and tell me the stock is undervalued, that's not enough for me. It's just one of many tools that I'm going to use. Now, the DCF is good because it allows you to use scenario analysis, and it allows you to see what the primary drivers of value are for a particular business, because the primary drivers of value are not the same for every business. For a really high margin, high ROIC business, the primary driver of value is by far organic revenue growth, by far, and you can play with the model and see that clear as day. For a low margin, low ROIC business, organic revenue growth actually destroys value, as you know. In that case, the primary driver of value is an increase in margins or ROIC to where it gets above the cost of capital. And you can see that clear as day by playing with the model. And so it does show you clearly what the levers of value are.
Let's talk about a couple of those screens. Just to close the chapter here on Tillinghast, you know, this is a guy that over 34 years outperformed by an average of 379 basis points, outperformed the market over a 34-year career by, like you said, almost 4 percentage points a year. And then by the end, you know, was managing $26 billion of capital. I mean, those are phenomenal numbers. The world has changed a lot in 34 years. It's easier to now do screens today and find those companies than it was three decades ago. But I think it's really interesting. Something you pointed out in this piece, in this interview you did, John, is when you have somebody with a track record like Joel, and then he also has got the performance to show it, he shared exactly what he's looking for. He shared exactly the metrics that he screens for when he's looking for companies. And a couple of the specifics that he was looking for: return on equity of greater than 10%, return on invested capital greater than 10%, free cash flow that is greater than net income, long-term debt divided by EBITDA of less than 4x, a little bit of insider ownership, and then a PE ratio of less than 23x and a company that's buying back shares. That seems kind of like a broad-based screen, but of course, it's necessary, right? He's looking for value companies that are undervalued out there that he can now predictably understand what their intrinsic value is worth. Any thoughts on the screen that Joel uses and why specifically this has driven so much outperformance over 34 years?
Yeah, and you know, so that screen is, you know, a first level. Once he gets there, then he dives much, much, much deeper. You know, I think Peter Lynch said he was one of the greatest investors to ever live, and that he was, I don't know if it's otherworldly analytical or something like that, but he's incredibly analytical. He dives deep into the numbers. So the screen is the extremes. Like, he won't ever go higher than a leverage ratio of 4, but he's very cautious around debt. And so in most cases, it's the debt to EBITDA is much less than 4, like much less than 4. And then he won't ever, or very rarely, pay higher than 23 times. But in most cases, it's much, 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 much lower. In the interview that we posted to your site, you know, he said for an average or middling business, he wants to pay a PE of single digits. That means less than 10. He then said for a above average, a good high quality business, he will pay, almost like it's hard for him to do it, but he will pay a teens multiple. And then he said, in the most extraordinary of cases, for the best businesses, he said he'll pay a low 20s. That's how I came up with the 23. I assume low 20s means 23. But that's in his most extreme case. This guy is not paying up. He's waiting for these great businesses that meet those criteria to trade down to low multiples of normalized earnings. And that's the thing. In the book, he talks all about normalized earnings, kind of mid-cycle normal. He's not just taking 1 year and assuming that denominator is what normal earnings power is. And then just really quickly, he's looking at these things over time. So he's not looking at the most recent fiscal year, the last 12 months, and saying, okay, our ROIC of at least 10%, free cash flow to net income of at least 100%. He's looking back at the averages over 10 years or more. He talks about what he loves about Value Line in the interview. He said, Value Line gives me 15 years of data. Like he's looking at the averages over time.
And he owned quite a few stocks in the fund, right? There's several hundred that were in the fund that he had, right?
I think when he retired at the end of 23, it was in the 700s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably an influence that he got from Peter Lynch. You know, Peter Lynch owned, you know, 1,000. So, he had a long tail, very long tail of small bets, optionality bets.
Yes. It's an interesting math, right? It's interesting, John. You know, he's not going to catch the NVIDIAs. He's not going to catch the Teslas. They're not going to show up in his universe that he wants to invest in. But he's just got such a collection of high-quality, predictable businesses that outperform over time. It's a strategy that works for a value investing legend. We'll jump into a couple of the individual companies here in a minute. And we're going to be chatting a little bit more about capital allocation, which is how companies turn business performance into investor performance. But quickly, I have a sponsored read. We actually have a sponsor that we'd like to go through really quickly. It's public.com. Hello, show listeners. You've probably heard us talk about the all-in-one investing platform, public.com, before. Public recently launched its options trading service. And in the industry first, they're offering members a rebate of 18 cents on every contract that's traded. But hurry, you have to activate options trading by March 31st. That's about 2 weeks from today. The good news is that once you lock in your rebate, you'll have it forever. So you can claim your rebate now and start trading whenever you're ready. Meanwhile, if you want to switch from your current brokerage, Public will reward you with up to $10,000. It only takes a few minutes to kickstart your transfer in one simple online process. So start earning a rebate of 18 cents on every options contract traded only at public.com. A quick disclosure that this was paid for by Public Investing. You must activate your options account by March 31st for the revenue share. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are available in our podcast text description, and it's for U.S. members only. John, with that said, let's get back to a couple of the individual companies that we found on this screen. We posted this to Twitter. We put it in the article too, but people are probably at this point asking, okay, great. Tillinghast has got an awesome screen. He's got 700 companies out there. Which ones might even be worthy of a future attention? So we ran that screen with the metrics that that we just discussed a couple of minutes ago. It came back 89 publicly traded companies that fit every one of those criteria that we just mentioned. A couple of the names that were mentioned that we're not going to chat about, but at least worth potentially looking deeper into, was Applied Materials, Best Buy, Carter's, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Meritage Homes. I want to talk about two, though, a little bit more in detail, because these are kind of off the radar of a lot of investors, you know, that are going out there looking for the NVIDIAs, looking for the Teslas, looking for a lot more exciting, sexier companies. But these two might not appear in a lot of those screens, but they did in Tillinghast. The first was Crocs, C-R-O-X. The second was American Eagle, A-E-O. And I bring these up because, you know, Crocs is a shoe retail. You know, they're making shoes out there. American Eagle is what I think of as the mall, bricks and mortar retail store that's been around for 30 years. But these are two companies that showed up, and I wanted to give a little bit of a commentary on each of them. John, please feel free to jump in with this if you'd like to, but at least to kind of start the research on why these are interesting. Crocs is selling at 9x earnings. This is right in the sweet spot of what Tillinghast likes to pay out there. It's probably a very undervalued stock, because when you're thinking about companies that are, you know, 7, 8, 9x earnings, there is not a whole lot of growth expectation baked into those companies. In fact, when you're talking about 7x earnings or less, you're kind of looking at an industry that's perpetually in decline, right? We're used to this for tobacco companies, maybe commercial real estate. A lot of these kind of retailers that we're chatting about, there's just such low expectations from the market. Crocs is interesting, though, because this is a company that in 5 years has quadrupled its revenue from $1 billion in 2018 to $4 billion in 2028. And its gross profit has also quadrupled over that same time, too. But it's been very conservative about its own costs, right? SG&A, selling, general, administrative, has only doubled in the same time frame. And when you've got revenue growing by $4 billion and your associated costs only up $3 billion, of course, that fell very quickly to the bottom line. Earnings over that five-year period have gone from $50 million a year to $800 million a year. It seems to me, John, that this is a company that's performing decently well, has been very conservative in its own cost structure, and at nine times earnings, perhaps is a good opportunity, a good bargain in the market out there. Any thoughts about Crocs?
Yeah, I have a few thoughts about Crocs. So my Twitter profile picture is of my Crocs.
I saw that. I did see that.
It's literally of my feet. So I have three pairs of Crocs. I have a pair that I wear outside. I have a pair that I wear only inside, almost like my house shoes, my slippers. And then I have a fleece line pair. I have eight nieces and nephews. I've probably bought five pairs for them over the years. You know, just to put some numbers on this, like you said, 5-year revenue CAGR, I'm in Cap IQ right now, through the end of 2023, 30%, 5-year revenue CAGR. 5-year unlevered free cash flow CAGR, 50%. So, you know, it seems this is not a slow grower like the multiple is implying. I think it has a low multiple because people, I believe, incorrectly assume that Crocs are a fashion fad. Crocs have been around forever. I mean, they've been around for at least 20 years, I think. I've had mine for, you know, going on 15 years. I don't know when this company was founded. Obviously, I could look it up easily. I just don't have it in front of me. But I've had mine for 15 years. It's, you know, high return on equity. And I'm talking like high, like 60, 70, 80, 90, 100% returns on equity, growing very rapidly. You know, the other thing I think the market was concerned about was that it made this sort of big-ish acquisition for Hey Dude. And they took on some debt to do that. And it sort of changed the financial profile a bit. I don't think it's as negative as the 9x multiple would imply. I like Crocs.
It's done quite well. Yeah, it certainly fits the screen. It's an interesting one. CROX, if you want to follow along with that one. And send John a note if you need a pair of Crocs. I think that he is a good purchaser helping that top line too.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The other one, American Eagle, you know, this is like I said, I always think of this as the mall store, right? This was trendy back when we were in high school 30 years ago. It's still there. It's still going. You know, so many of those other kind of bricks and mortar retailers have shut down, have closed their doors. American Eagle is still going strong out there. This is one that had a really good year last year, John. It was up 53% in 2023. You know, it's kind of one that has been a steady grower. Revenue from 5 years ago, $3.8 billion, about $5 billion here today. You know, gross profits, $1.4 to $1.7 billion. It's done decently well. It's kind of kept a slow mid-digit growth in operating income and net income out there. But the thing that's really interesting that I think that has been maybe worth considering today is that valuation multiple has contracted so significantly. When I say valuation multiple, I mean the multiple of what a company is paying for or what the market is paying for either earnings or for free cash flow. Specifically for free cash flow, again, as the business has been around for several decades, it is churning out cash flow. Back in 2021, this is a business that traded at 40 times free cash flow. Today, it's trading at 7.7 times free cash flow. So even though you've kind of got steady growth, right, we're seeing a company that's increasing its earnings power, it's increasing its free cash flows every year. It seems cheap. It seems like a company that is still growing same store sales 6% a year. It's getting 19% growth on its online channels. Gross margin improves 340 basis points year over year. Still churning out free cash flow, but it's selling less than 8x price to FCF. John, any thoughts about American Eagle? It still seems like a Tillinghast kind of value stock out there.
This is one I have not looked at, but I will say, based on what you just read, It it has piqued my interest enough, Simon, to go to a few malls and walk through the stores, right? And see what they look like, how they're merchandised, how crowded they are, check out the product lineup, you know, check out the customer service. And so it is interesting enough for me to, the next time that I do go to a mall, I'll make a point to walk into the stores and check them out.
It is. It's so interesting. You know, this type of investing, modelable companies, right? You know, there's not a whole lot of unknowns out there. Crocs, American Eagle, you can model these. Wall Street has modeled these, but still the bar is very low. And, you know, if you hold on to the good companies that just continue to outperform like this over 10, 20 year periods, you get a record like Tillinghast. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, you don't have to be right on all of them, right? You just buy, yeah. I was going to say a basket, but he bought 700. But you know, if you buy 7, 8, 9, 10 of these, you know, and you're right on 5 or 6, and you hold them long enough for as long as they remain good and undervalued, you can do quite well.
John, my last question is, why do you think that Peter Lynch was such a fan of Joel Tillinghast? What do you think his greatest strengths were that set him afar from the rest of the pack of institutional investors?
I haven't spoken to Peter Lynch about this, but based on Peter Lynch's prologue to the book, and based on what I have learned about Joel, I would say that Joel is an incredibly independent thinker. Incredibly independent. He's contrarian in his DNA. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, maybe two more things. He's an intrinsic value investor. You know, when I asked him what his secret sauce was in the interview that we posted to your site, he said, you know, quote unquote, something to the effect of, I compare a stock price to what I think its intrinsic value is. He's an intrinsic value-based investor. And then the third thing is that he's incredibly smart and analytical. He can analyze and sort through mountains of numbers and mountains of data. I mean, think 700 companies, right, in his portfolio. And he has a big analyst team working for him, but he knows something about all those companies. And so he's just, the brain power is exceptional as well.
Well, fantastic job on the interview, John. We're going to include a link to it in this podcast show notes. We'll put it up on 7investing.com. Thanks again for doing that and making it available for our audience. I learned a lot from it. I think that everybody that reads it would learn a lot from it as well. I want to shift gears. You know, we chatted a lot about Joel, but let's talk a little bit more about a lot of those screens. You know, PE screen is very different than a price to free cash flow screen. Because you're dealing in earnings, which can be, you know, which are GAAP reported, you can manipulate earnings. You can do a lot of different levers you can pull to change those, versus the cash is actually going out the door or being generated for the benefit of shareholders, like free cash flow implies. This is a two beer conversation, John. We could go a zillion different directions with this. And you and I have certainly over the last decade.
You but and maybe I are from the South. Maybe this is a 3-beer conversation.
Probably, at least, right? And get some Southern beers, some of those New Orleans beers. Maybe one, though, that I think if we wanted to make this a 1-beer podcast conversation, is the concept of stock-based compensation. Because so many companies are tech companies right now, right? So many companies pay heavily with equity, with shares, with options. And that's kind of par for the course now. If you're hiring tech talent, you almost have to do that. Silicon Valley has made several decades of making this the norm. But stock-based compensation is something that would deduct from earnings and show up in the denominator of a price-to-earnings ratio, but then is added back to the free cash flow number when you're looking at price-to-free cash flows out there. And so a lot of companies, especially tech companies, you'll see these astronomically high cash flow numbers, and then these kind of much more conservatively reported earnings numbers. And a lot of it is because of these non-cash charges, specifically stock-based compensation. Let me open that conversation up to you, John. I mean, you're really right there into the financial statements every time you're looking at companies. Where do you stand on stock-based compensation? Is this a good practice? Is this something that's gotten out of hand out there? What do you feel about stock-based comp?
I think it's gotten out of hand by some companies in some industries, but I don't really care so much how a company decides to compensate their employees. as much as I do, that I, you know, I don't like that they add it back to adjusted earnings, and I don't like that they report that they have high free cash flow margins. Although reporting is perfectly in line with accounting standards. You know, it is, according to accounting rules, added back in the operating cash flows section of the cash flow statement. I don't like that. I think that's insane and perverse. The accounting rules. I think it's insane and perverse. I think that stock-based compensation is clearly an equity raise. And an equity raise is a financing activity. And so I think it should be included in the financing section of the cash flow statement. That would remove confusion, and we would have a more accurate picture of what true sustainable economic free cash flow is. I have nothing against stock-based compensation. I just am against how some companies use it to suggest they have these huge free cash flow margins.
And let's look at a couple of those, right? Just to show some examples of what this looks like out there. And this is, again, there's not a clear good or bad line between this. It's just, you know, a little bit of how you interpret this. One that's worth looking deeper into is Broadcom. AVGO is the ticker for this one. This is a company that's in the semiconductor industry, highly acquisitive, pays a ton of stock-based compensation, especially to the companies that's acquiring. You know, it's issuing shares that it's giving now to the owners of those companies, and then also to its own executives, right? There's a company, John, that's churning at a 45% free cash flow margin. Okay. Which is really, really high. That's fantastically high. And then even something we just talked about on Twitter is during its most recent quarter, it paid out, at least in the reported earnings announcement, 90% of revenue through shareholder returns, either as a dividend or as a share repurchase. And you look at it and you say 90% of revenue that's paying out, you know, for me as a good, for the good of me as shareholder, and 45% free cash flow margin. This has got to be a fantastic company. And to be clear, Broadcom is a fantastic company. Last 10 years, total return for shareholders, 1,910%. That's a fantastic company. 19-bagger, you know, 18-bagger for the company out there. But there's some nuance to this, right? Stock-based compensation is fantastic for employees, and it's fantastic for investors when the stock price is going up, as Broadcom stock has been going up. It's also proven to be terrible when a stock price falls. Snapchat, we saw this, you know, a lot of Silicon Valley companies are just kind of, during the zero interest rate policy, were shooting to the moon, issuing tons of stock-based compensation, everybody's popping champagne values or bottles, and then the rug gets pulled out from underneath them, right? The music stops, they stop getting paid in equity, the stock price gets cut in half, if not worse than that, and all of a sudden you've got huge layoffs and nobody got paid for the work that they did. So it seems like it's a double-edged sword, you know, in Broadcom's case. It's interesting because you see a company that on the surface of it is buying back a ton of shares, is generating huge free cash flow margins, yet its outstanding share count, John, is still increasing because of the shares that it's paying to its executives and because of the shares that it's issuing for its own acquisitions. And I think as investors, at least the takeaway from me, I'll hand it to you here in just a second, but I think the takeaway from me is you have to account for that. You can't just dismiss it or put it in a footnote. When you've got a company that's part of the capital allocation strategy, you've got to account for that somewhere, either in the shared dilution of what you're expecting in the future, or at least kind of consider it a you know, apples to apples cash charge, because you're not just paying cash bonuses. You're paying for this somewhere, even if it's not a cash charge. Any thoughts on all this, John? I went off on a little bit of a tangent on that, but your thoughts on stock-based comp or Broadcom?
Yeah, you know, I think that you make a good point that a company that doesn't have a wide moat. You know, if it's a weak business with a deteriorating moat, with a weak business model, the last thing you want a company doing in that situation is buying back stock, even if it trades at a low multiple. Because those are like the Snapchats. Those are the you know, and those are the value traps, basically. These are companies that have very weak fundamentals, very weak business models, low barriers to entry, no moat. It's not a beloved product. It's not really relevant, but it optically trades at a low PE. And so some investors, not necessarily Snapchat, but in general, some investors think it's cheap. You don't want that company buying back stock, even though the PE is low, because it's a deteriorating value. The intrinsic value is falling. And you saw that in places like Bed Bath & Beyond, which was taking on massive amounts of debt to buy back stock that optically traded at a low PE, and the stores were empty. No one wanted to go to a Bed Bath & Beyond anymore because you could buy it cheaper and better elsewhere. You know, you saw that at Intel under previous leadership. Intel for a time was leading in semiconductor manufacturing. It ended up resting on its laurels. It ended up mortgaging its future, not investing enough into fortifying that moat, not investing enough into research and development, and instead just decided to buy back a lot of stock. And the result of that was it gave up its competitive lead to AMD, Taiwan Semiconductor, and NVIDIA. And now it's playing catch up under a new great leader, which has refocused the capital allocation framework on what is needed for Intel in this day and age. So yeah, buying back stock, even when the multiple is optically cheap, is not always the right decision. In that case, if a company does have excess cash, it's, you know, smarter to return it as a dividend or a special dividend. As a general rule, and then I'll turn it back to you, Simon, as a general rule, if a company has high ROIC reinvestment opportunities, you want them investing every penny that they can into those high ROIC reinvestment opportunities. If they have an opportunity to reinvest every dollar of earnings of capital back into the business at high ROICs, it would be a crime to buy back stock or pay a dividend. But if it does not have competitively advantaged investment opportunities that are going to earn an ROIC above the cost of capital, then it should return capital to shareholders. I don't think enough companies return capital to shareholders. And then the question becomes, what is the right balance between dividends, special dividends, and share repurchase?
This is culture, right? This is like the brass tacks of a company. Is like, this is a culture. And we don't mean culture like free breakfast for all employees in the mornings. We mean the culture of like, what is the company's discipline on how it's using the money that it's created for the good of shareholders, right? How does it make decisions? What is the executive? Like you just mentioned, Intel's a perfect example, right? If you've got a CFO that's kind of running the ship, he's buying back a ton of shares, he's draining the capital out of the business rather than reinvesting it, he's going to lose share to Taiwan Sing, which is exactly what Intel did. And then on the design front, like you said, to NVIDIA and AMD, they could have seen that coming, you know, but they certainly did not invest in the business like they needed. And now you see Pat Gelsinger, like you just mentioned, Intel is a fascinating case because you've got the guy that worked with Gordon Moore decades ago back at the helm saying, hey, I want to steer this ship in the right direction. You see that they've made some difficult decisions, laying off tens of thousands of employees, cutting that dividend by 2/3, you know, kind of
pulling back on buybacks too.
Yeah, pulling back. I'm like basically saying, we're not going to financially engineer this business anymore. We're investing in the Foundry Group because we want to woo Apple and the other tech companies to use Intel's foundries rather than Taiwan Semis. Fascinating case, John. I'm glad you brought up Intel.
But, you know, there are cases where buybacks are not only the right opportunity, but by far the most value accretive opportunity. Warren Buffett has said on multiple occasions, the surest way to grow per share intrinsic value is to buy back undervalued stock.
I want to talk about a couple of red flags. You know, yeah. We've talked about kind of Intel, I think is at least in my opinion, a good case. I think they're doing right by shareholders for capital allocation. And again, when we say capital allocation, there's a couple options that management can use their profit streams, specifically their cash flows, for the good of shareholders, right? You can just let it sit on the balance sheet like Apple did for a long time. You could reinvest it into growing your business more and more every year, like Amazon did, you know, capital expenditures, servers, things like those. You can make an acquisition. You go out and buy another company, M&A. You can pay a dividend, which is you're taking cash out of the business, giving it to your shareholders, or you can repurchase your own shares. And we've kind of discussed a lot of those. There's give and takes for a lot of them.
You can also pay down debt, which is
and pay down debt. We agree, long term debt
benefit to shareholders because shareholders have a residual claim on the cash flows.
Mm-hmm. And companies that are capital intensive, like American Tower, kind of comes to mind immediately. You know, you've got kind of this these thresholds. You know, you've got these line items and spreadsheets of businesses saying, you know, this is how much we're going to use to pay down debt this quarter. This is how much we're going to be paying out as a dividend. I mean, it's
they
very
prioritize
methodical.
Their capital allocation, right? So a lot of companies, you'll see them say, our number one priority for free cash flow allocation is to maintain a leverage ratio in the 2 to 3 times range, right? So their number one priority is paying down debt once it hits that 3, once it hits the high end of that range. Then, you know, take it from there. Then maybe it's, you know, growing the dividend in line with earnings. And then maybe it's, you know, opportunistic tuck-in acquisitions. And then it's opportunistic buybacks. But they prioritize the allocation of that free cash flow.
And I will say, John, you know, we've talked about companies like Constellation Software before. They do acquisitions very, very well. Some companies are very methodical about how they acquire. Warren Buffett, of course, has been acquiring company over years. But a lot of companies will really screw up the M&A cap allocation piece, right? They'll go out and make boneheaded acquisitions. It's the surest where a bad acquisition is the surest way to light shareholder capital on fire. We saw this with HP. Hewlett-Packard, kind of the notorious example, goes out and spends $10 billion on autonomy, a software company. Writes it down, I believe, $9 billion within 18 months. You know, that's kaput, right? That's Altria, you know, the cigarette company, goes out and buys Juul, writes it down within 2 years. I mean, a bad acquisition.
You see this all the time. You see it with Microsoft buying the handset business from, what was it? They bought some foreign handset business. You saw it with Teladoc buying Livongo,
and they
immediately write these things down. Yeah.
And it's tempting, right? At the time, you know, you don't want to get left behind. You don't want to get disrupted. You don't want to have a smaller company displacing you or taking market share. I understand why companies make acquisitions, but a lot of times they don't do a very good job with this. Maybe they need to be watching your interview with Tillinghast.
Yeah, you feel a lot of times executives feel powerful making a big deal, right? They're in the headlines. They announce a $2 billion deal. Sometimes they get paid based on revenue growth. What's the easiest way to grow revenue? Make a big acquisition, right? And so it's a lot of times it's power trips and things like that.
I've got two that are red flags. I want to point these out on the show. John, I'd love to hear your thoughts on these, but at least two that are worth digging into deeper. These are great companies. These are companies that are very large, you know, large cap companies that have been around for a long time, but it seems like sometimes if you get into this capital allocation, you know, every year you pay out a dividend, you just get used to kind of always paying so much for the, you know, for dividend, you get so much for paying, buying back shares. Maybe you're doing it to keep Wall Street happy. Maybe you're doing it for financial engineering purposes, but sometimes maybe there should be a little bit more discretion on things like this that should be scrutinized like Intel did here in the last year. The first one that kind of comes to mind is Home Depot. You know, Home Depot, of course, the largest do-it-yourself retailer out there, a huge company, but it's got really some weakness in its business right now. Consumer discretionary spend is down. Same store sales during fiscal 23 were down 3.5%. Management even guided for another 1% decline in same store sales here in 2024 for forward sales. And it's kind of broad-based, right? Transactions were down. Average ticket was down. This is just kind of a tough time. This retailer, and of course, Home Depot is going to be fine. I don't think that Home Depot is going bankrupt or anything else bad from this. But they raised $2 billion in debt because they wanted to continue paying their dividend and they wanted to continue to buy back shares that they've gotten used to. And now, because of the slip in earnings, the stock is selling at a five-year high of a PE multiple of 24x. It just seems like something like that is a red flag to me. You know, perhaps when business is a little bit weaker in a cyclical market, like we see with consumer spending for do-it-yourself retailers, maybe you don't need to keep stepping quite so aggressively on the gas pedal, especially when it comes to buyback and dividends. Any thoughts on Home Depot, John?
I'm probably less concerned with Home Depot because I think this is just operates in a cyclical industry. And then on top of that, it had a extreme cycle and it's still overcoming some, believe it or not, some COVID grow over, some COVID comps. Home Depot has always run with large amount of debt. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but 40, 45 billion in debt, net debt, even in the $30 billion range, I think. but they generate, I believe, stable enough free cash flows to manage it. I don't have the sort of interest coverage, you know, I could look it up really quickly, but, or the net debt to free cash flow, you know, basically net debt to free cash flow would be how many years would it take Home Depot to pay off all of its net debt with sort of an average normal free cash flow. I don't expect that to be much higher than like 3 to 4 years, but maybe it is. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think over time, maybe the biggest concern for me with Home Depot, Simon, is, look, I don't like debt either, but it's also, it doesn't have opportunities to grow its store base. It's, you know, maybe opening 2, 3, 4 stores a year. And so growth is coming from growing sales within each store. It's online business, it's omni-channel business. It's MRO business, maintenance and repair business, but not from opening new stores. And so a lot of the easy growth is sort of done with, right? And so that's why at this stage of its life cycle, I think Home Depot is more into this sort of capital allocation phase of its life, if that makes any sense.
It certainly does. And I agree. And the digital channels, you know, just training, you know, they're really big with contractors, you know, transactional business, training them to just use the app, place the order, pick it up at the store, and then as quickly as possible get what you need. They've invested in that a lot. Still a 14% operating margin business. It seems like it's going to do just fine. It's just that you don't love to see them raising debt just to pay out the dividend and buy back shares. I mean, it doesn't seem like this is a very opportune time to be doing so.
So I pulled up the numbers. I was low. It has $52 billion in debt, $48 billion in net debt. Okay, $48 billion in net debt. Its interest coverage ratio is currently 11, which I consider to be safe. So by EBIT to interest expense, I mean, how many times could 1 year of EBIT, 1 year of operating income, pay its interest expense? And basically, this suggests that 1 year of Home Depot's operating income could pay 11 years worth of its interest expense. Now, to be fair, that 11 number is lower than it's been in the last 5. But I do think that margins are compressed a little bit and earnings may be compressed a little bit. So maybe in a more normalized environment, its EBIT to interest expense should average about 12 to 13, which is what I think I have in my model, but I haven't updated it in a while. So numbers are a little below average, but they're not overly concerning to me. Now, in all fairness, maybe I have a little bit of a blind spot with Home Depot because it's a long-term holding of mine.
As am mine too, John. It's a fantastic company.
And I love that you're pointing this out. If we don't look at red flags, then we're just flying blind.
I've got another one that's a favorite of you and me that you and I have chatted a lot about how good of a return on invested capital this company has posted for decades now. And it's in my very home state of Texas. It's Texas Instruments, John. You know, I've heard you wax poetic about this company. It's a fantastic company. Really, really good returns on invested capital. There's no debating that at all. But let's get into the nitty-gritty. Let's look at a couple things that maybe are potentially worth digging into more as an investor. Again, this is an analog chip maker. You know, they've got their own fabs. They're spending tons of money right now on capital expenditures because the Inflation Reduction Act wants domestic supply of these chips, right? And so you get a 30% tax break basically on equipment that's used into fabrication and construction equipment. And so you've got a company, Texas Instruments, with a very, very weakness again in the business right now, especially in industrial and automotive markets. Had a 13% drop in its fourth quarter revenue. During all of 2023, its operating cash flow fell 26% down to $6 billion. And yet, even with declining sales, declining cash flows, because it's taking advantage of those tax credits, CapEx budget was up 81% during 2023. Now to $5 billion. Part of the capital allocation plan, right? They put this right in front of shareholders. But the advantage or the combination of fewer cash flows coming in the door and then greater capital expending is basically free cash flow fell 77% year over year, right? Only $1.4 billion for the year. And that's not enough to cover the $4.5 billion it paid in dividends and then the $300 million it did in repurchases. Now, to be fair, it did kind of cut back on its repurchases this year, didn't have a whole lot of money coming in organically to fund those. And so it pulled back on that a little bit, but it still goes out, John, and it issues $3 billion worth of debt between 4.6 and 5.1%, right? Just to pay that dividend consistently that its shareholders want to see. TI is a fantastic business. It's going to be around, it's got 100,000 customers, you know, 80,000 products or something, analog chips that it's selling out there. But in terms of capital allocation, I don't think I love this move of going out there and raising debt, you know, putting $3 billion of debt on your balance sheet at 5% just to pay out a dividend that you could really, really quickly cut back on in a time like this when you're seeing a decline in sales, a decline in cash flows. This one raised a little bit of a red flag for me with TI.
So once again, so TI is going through a, in my opinion, a more difficult phase of its life cycle than is Home Depot. Home Depot, in my opinion, is just as relevant as ever. It's just going through some hard comps from that COVID grow over. And, you know, I think it's going to be fine. I also think Texas Instruments is going to be fine, but there are two things that are transformational changes at Texas Instruments. One is they have a new CEO. You know, the former CEO is a legend. And they have a new CEO who I'm less comfortable with just because he's newer. And then their CapEx profile is not only higher currently, and by higher, I mean like more than double what it was historically, but it's going to remain higher for a while. And so they are in a massive CapEx cycle right now. I believe that when they come out of this CapEx cycle, whenever it is, 5-6 years down the road, that they will come out with faster organic growth, more market share, higher margins and higher returns on invested capital at a time when the world is going to need so many analog chips. You cannot run anything in the digital age without analog chips. They're really, really important. It's sort of a paradox. People think everything's going digital, but the more digital we go, the more analog we need to manage things like power and battery. It's going to take them a while to get there, Simon. And it could be the financials are going to look uglier than normal for a while. I don't know how long that's going to take. Just, you know, maybe at a high level, really good long life businesses, they go through multiple life cycles. So it's not like, you know, in business school, you kind of learn, and you know this, but I'm just speaking out loud. In business school, you kind of learn that businesses are founded, and then they go through a hyper growth phase, and then they mature, and then they decline. And then they die. Well, it's not always like that. We just talked about Intel, right? Like companies can go through multiple of these S curves, as they're called, in their life. It's not just a linear, you're born and you die. And so companies that, you know, have 30, 40, 50, 60, 100-year histories or longer go through multiple of these life cycles, multiple of these investment cycles. Sometimes they grow faster, sometimes they grow slower. But I believe that both Home Depot and Texas Instruments have staying power and relevance and very wide moats that will allow them to survive a difficult part of the cycle and then thrive coming out of it.
I think that's a perfect description of it, John. You know, and like we said, kind of to frame this all back together again, capital allocation is important to investors. The way the companies are spending capital on your behalf is very important to the investment returns. And I think that a lot of industries, especially the semiconductor industry right now in particular, has gotten used to kind of stable, pay a dividend, you know, buy back shares like we saw with Intel several years ago. And now with this, you know, Sam Altman going out there saying, hey, $7 trillion we need to raise to do the training of the next era of AI. There's going to be a lot of chips out there. There's going to be a lot of demand. And perhaps that equation is shifting from dividends and buybacks to organic reinvestment into the business and capital expenditures.
Yeah. And one last thing I'll say is, you know, you can, people can manage their portfolios however they want, but I just want to encourage, there's nothing wrong with trimming a stock. You don't have to sell out of a stock completely. You're not abandoning it, right? And so I've owned Home Depot and Texas Instruments probably for, I don't know, Home Depot for more than 10 years. Texas Instruments probably going on 10 years. If I'm concerned about something, I can trim it. I can trim Home Depot. I can trim Texas Instruments to make it a smaller weighting in the portfolio. It doesn't mean that I have to get out of it completely, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with trimming a position when these occasional concerns pop up. And if you own a business long enough, if you own a compounder long enough, these concerns are going to pop up. Nothing is ever perfect forever, right? And so when these things happen, yeah, I'll trim back a little. Does that make sense?
It certainly is. My goodness, what a fantastic discussion we've had here today. We've kind of run the full gamut about how companies are using their money for the good of shareholders. We've talked about things like stock-based compensation as an alternative to a cash bonus. We've talked about dividends. We've talked about buybacks. We've talked about capital expenditures. We've talked about some examples of companies that are doing those well and maybe not so well. We've talked about how to screen for those companies and the things to look for, especially with an investing legend like Joel Tillinghast. It's been really nice talking with another investing legend here, John Rotanti, again, one of my favorites in the business, especially when it comes to educating investors to make better decisions. John, I really appreciated this. Thanks for being on the 7 Investing Podcast here this morning.
Simon, thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come back on. I have one last parting piece of data for your listeners. I just quickly did the math. Home Depot has averaged over the past 5 years about $13.5 billion in annual free cash flow. That's an average over the past 5 years. Current net debt, $48.4 billion. So it's current net debt to average free cash flow over the past 5 years is 3.5. So it would take Home Depot 3.5 years to pay off all of its net debt with its average free cash flow. Simon, thank you so much for having me on. I think 7 Investing is incredible. I love all you're doing. I love your incredible stock picking from your team and the transparency that you share. And I hope we can do this again soon.
Absolutely. And definitely follow John's own podcast, The J. Rowe Show. John, what's the URL that people can go to check out your own podcast there?
I have no idea. It's on Spotify, and Apple, yeah, and YouTube. I don't even know about that stuff.
J-R-O Show. I can go on Spotify and search for J. Rowe Show, right?
Yeah. So I literally what I do is I go to Google and I type in J. Rowe Show Spotify. Then I type in J. Rowe Show Apple and J. Rowe Show YouTube, and it all comes up. But it's on iHeart. It's on all the major Amazon podcasts, on all the major platforms.
Absolutely. John's one of my favorite investors out there. Really a pleasure chatting with him here today. I hope that you've enjoyed the show, everyone. This has been yet another successful 7 Investing Podcast. And please come vote with us. We're going to be putting Crocs and American Eagle into our own stock picking competition that we're running alongside our partner Stock Card. We're gonna be picking one of those two companies for our own entry for the 7 Investing portfolio. So that's a wrap for this episode. You can check out all of our podcasts at 7investing.com/podcast or see all of our recommendations at 7investing.com/recommendations. We thank you very much for tuning in. Until next time, we're here to empower you to invest in your future. We are 7 Investing.